It's the 200th birthday year for the Royal Botanic Garden in Sydney, and so we're celebrating throughout 2016 in the Science Show. It is our oldest centre of science research in this country. But what do they do apart from running an exquisite garden in one of the prime sites on Earth? Well, they examine the origins and classification of plants on which our lives depend and our enjoyment. Those flowers, those fruits, that food. Dr. Peter Weston is one of the leading researchers in the gardens, and his joy is the Proteaceae. But why? What made you choose Proteaceae?
Oh, that was an accident of history. When I was choosing a project for my PhD, I wanted to work on chromosomes, and I was advised to work on a genus called Pisonia, also known as G-bungs, which is a native group of plants that have really large chromosomes. So that's how I got into it. And then I found that the family had all sorts of other interesting things that were a lot more interesting than their chromosomes, really.
It's amazing. I would have come to Proteaceae because they've got so dirty, great, big, wonderful flowers.
Well, yeah, some of them have. The ones we know well have whopping great big flowers like Banksias and Waratahs and some of the Grevilleas. And then some of them have very small flowers. There's one that I worked on recently from Madagascar, but I worked on it in Paris, called Dilobia thuasii, which has masses of tiny flowers. And as I was working on it, I realised that this thing must be wind-pollinated because they had these tiny flowers, but they whopping great big catches to catch the pollen that was blown from the male trees to the female trees.
I associate the group very much with Australia.
It's a pretty reasonable thing to do because most of the diversity is in Australia, but there's a lot of them in South Africa, and that's pretty much the secondary centre of diversity in the world. But they're also in South America, other parts of
Gondwana,
Gondwana,
indeed,
yeah,
yes.
That's right. So almost all of the fragments of Gondwana other than Antarctica have Proteaceae living on them. And when continental drift became really strongly corroborated as plate tectonics back in the 1960s and 1970s, our first reaction really was to argue that, okay, that means that groups like the Proteaceae that are spread across the southern hemisphere got to where they are by continental drift. And subsequently, we've been able to test that idea in great detail because of advances in technology. We can now reconstruct the precise branching sequence of evolving lineages from the past in great detail using analyses of DNA sequences. So we now have this exquisitely detailed family tree for the Proteaceae down to the level of a genera. So that's the groups like Banksia and Grevillea and so on. And that allows us to test all sorts of ideas about their history, including where they were in the past. A fascinating thing that emerged from that research was that some of the groups that had been regarded as these classic Gondwanan relics from when all of the land masses of the southern hemisphere were together seemed to be just far too young to have got there by continental drift. So, for instance, in Africa, southern Africa, the biggest group there in numbers of species is a group called the Leucodendri, which is a difficult word, but it includes Leucodendron, which you can often buy in the florist, and Leucospermum, which you can also get in the florist. And that group, according to our best estimates, is only about 40 million years old. And to have walked between Australia and Africa across Gondwana when they were still together, they'd have to be at least 105 million years old. So
mystery.
We concluded they must have got there by long-distance dispersal across the developing Indian Ocean about 40 million years ago. And similarly, a group that really fascinated me was a group called the Macadamiae, which includes the genus Macadamia, which gives us macadamia nuts. They're endemic in southeastern Queensland and northeastern New South Wales, but they're related to species in North Queensland and Sulawesi in Indonesia, and also in tropical South America and the Cape region, the Western Cape of South Africa. But the best estimate we have for the age of that group is about 30 million years. So once again, they're far too young to have got to where they are by continental drift, if our estimates are correct.
So dispersal is the name of the game. Now, I have a terrible confession to make. I love macadamia nuts. I have no picture of what the plant looks like.
I've got one growing in my backyard. You can grow them easily in Sydney. They're small rainforest trees, maybe some of them look a bit nondescript. Some of them have quite prickly leaves and they have these dangly lines of flowers that turn into some nuts when they're pollinated by native bees.
And it is true that they are just about the only endemic foodstuff that the Europeans have exploited in this country.
They're the only ones that have become a viable commercial proposition. Yeah,
about which the Hawaiians are very happy.
Well, Hawaiians, rather than Australians, actually developed them as a crop. So all of the cultivars that are still grown in our macadamia orchards, so far as I know, were developed in Hawaii.
And all this began because you were looking for chromosomes. Now, is that the concentration of your research, to find out how these creatures spread?
Well, for many years, that was the main focus of my research. And we derived this beautiful tree diagram for the Proteaceae, showing its evolutionary genealogy, with that idea in mind to reconstruct where they were in the past. But those kind of trees can be used for all sorts of other purposes in biological science. So a project that I've been involved in very recently, last year, took me to Europe. I was fortunate to win a Winston Churchill Fellowship sponsored by the Australian Biological Resources Study, and they funded me to go and work there on the evolution of flowers in the Proteaceae, how the floral shape has changed in the various different lineages over the last 90 or 100 million years. So why I was going there was to work with a research group at the University of South Paris who are very interested in the evolution of the development of proteaceous flowers. So they're particularly interested in the evolution of floral symmetry. So primitively, flowering plants are thought to have been radially symmetrical. So they had lots of different lines of symmetry you could draw through a flower. So you can imagine a flower like a buttercup is radially symmetrical. But bilaterally symmetrical flowers have only one axis of symmetry. So the most obvious example of that that most people would think of is an orchid. You can draw one line through an orchid flower and you get two mirror images on either side of it. Well, that kind of floral symmetry, my research has shown, has evolved at least 16 different times within the Proteaceae, which makes the Proteaceae a hotspot amongst the flowering plants for the evolution of bilateral symmetry. You might think, well, so what? But this is an interesting aspect of floral development. And looking at the Proteaceae will help us to understand the rules or the processes by which flowers develop and how different kinds of development evolve in different groups of plants. So, you know, why is the Proteaceae such a hotbed of change from radial symmetry to bilateral symmetry? One answer might be adaptively advantageous for their pollination. So an idea that has probably got a fair bit going for it in floral biology is that bilaterally symmetrical flowers can ensure that pollen is placed more precisely on a pollinating animal than in these radially symmetrical flowers.
And it's more focused, it's more directed.
Yeah, that's right. So if you look at a grevillea flower, it's got a part called the style, which actually has the pollen on its tip and it loops over, and the birds that pollinate many of these grevilleas stick their beaks into the base of the inside of a flower to suck nectar from there. And as they're doing that, this bent style hooks over and dabs them on the head and whacks some pollen onto their head. And if the flowers are a little bit older, all the pollen will be gone. But now they're in a female receptive phase and they can dab onto those little patches of pollen on the heads of the honey eaters that are visiting them and be pollinated by that.
It's so elegant. I have a final question for you. In this 200th anniversary of the Royal Botanic Gardens in Sydney, what are you doing, Peter, to celebrate this year?
I'm writing up a whole lot of my research, actually.
But you do that all the time.
I do that, but just at the moment I've got a number of projects that are coming to fruition, so it's quite an exciting time for me. We've got a number of projects that are organisational projects to celebrate it. I guess the most well-known of which is the Calyx, which is the new exhibition centre that's being built in the Botanic Gardens as part of the redevelopment of a tropical centre.
Opens in June.
Yep.
Thank you.
It's a pleasure.
And we shall help them celebrate their 200th anniversary throughout 2016. Peter Weston is a senior principal research scientist at the Royal Botanic Garden in Sydney.